Welcome to Scope It Out. In this edition, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Ferenc. They will discuss the article Evaluation of Patient Nasal Saline Irrigation Practices Following Endoscopic Sinus Surgery. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by Medical Center Pharmacy, leaders in topical sinus therapy for chronic sinusitis and polyp patients. Founded in 1990, MCP provides innovative formulations that combine steroid, antibiotic, and antifungal treatments. These medications are instilled directly into the sinuses using various devices. Successful insurance billing, thorough patient education, and prompt delivery are why physicians and patients trust MCP as their premier pharmacy. Please visit www.mcpnc.com or call 1-800-930-8785 for more information.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Elizabeth Ferenc from Southern California, and we will be discussing her article, which is currently available in Early View online, entitled Evaluation of Patient Nasal Saline Irrigation Practices Following Endoscopic Sinus Surgery. Elizabeth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, sinonasal irrigation has become such an important treatment modality in the management of patients, not just with chronic rhinosinusitis, but with all kinds of nasal and sinus symptoms and problems. There's no question that it has become an incredibly important treatment modality, I think, in the mind of most folks. In the postoperative patient, in the patient undergoing endoscopic sinus surgery, in the postoperative course, and in fact, when I'm talking to patients about indications and reasons to do endoscopic sinus surgery, I'm telling them that one of the biggest reasons we're doing it is so that we can apply topical therapies to the nose and sinuses after this surgery, and we can add certain things to saline like topical steroid therapy and deliver it much more effectively into the nose and sinuses. But in your paper, you really concentrated on patients in the fairly immediate postoperative period. How did you come to gain an interest in that particular area?
Well, like you said, saline is pretty much universally recommended, but there's really no data about whether patients adhere to our postoperative recommendations. And we know from other literature that patients don't always take the medications that are prescribed to them. So we were curious to see if our patients were actually irrigating. I'm sure you've had the patients who've come back for their postoperative debridements, and you look in their nose and you wonder, given the amount of crusting, if they have been irrigating or irrigating correctly at home.
And yeah, drives me nuts when I look in there and I see that things aren't softened up or irrigation hasn't been done. It's one of the things that bothers me the most, I think.
And so we were curious to see, what does the average patient do once they leave our postoperative recovery unit until they come back and see us again?
Yeah. Well, it's a very reasonable question. And we know, and you wrote about this in your article, we know something about compliance, at least with medical therapies. I think you quoted in your paper something like on the order of 70% compliance for short-term medical therapy. Am I stating that fairly?
That's correct, and it's even worse for long-term medication.
Yeah.
Only in the 40 to 50% compliance.
I was kind of surprised that it was even as high as 70%. In shorter-term medications, I mean, I'm not familiar with the literature, but I've always wondered how compliant patients are with antibiotics and other things that we prescribe for them. 70% sounds pretty good to me, and even in the short term, which I imagine means a week or two or three after you've prescribed the medication.
Right. And I think that was one of what was so interesting with our findings is that our patients are actually very compliant with postoperative irrigations. We're ranking much better than medications up with adherence rates of over 80%.
Yeah, and you gave good reason for that. I mean, I think most of my patients come back to the clinic, the ones who are irrigating, and they're sold on irrigation. There is a small group who really cannot stand irrigating their nose and sinuses, and I don't think there's any way around that. There's just a small group. But most patients, once they learn to do this and start doing it, it's one of those things that they almost never give up, even if they could give it up. They get some immediate gratification and benefit from irrigating.
Right. And I think especially once patients learn how to irrigate well, I often have patients come in and say, oh, I irrigate and it goes up my eustachian tube and now I have ear trouble, and taking the time to actually show them how to irrigate correctly, or showing them a YouTube video with a 5-year-old able to irrigate correctly, makes a big difference to their ability to tolerate the irrigations in the long term.
Is there a particular type of irrigation? I mean, without using brand names, is there a particular type that you would utilize in your practice?
For this particular paper, everyone was handed, and it's the commonplace at UCLA, that everyone is handed a rinse bottle rather than a neti pot.
Yeah.
Although for patients,
so the squeeze, the softer kind of squeeze bottle variety.
Exactly. And then for patients who don't like that, then they are offered the option of more of the teapot variety of irrigations instead.
And I've definitely noticed that most of my patients seem to prefer the squeeze bottle variety, but there, again, is some group of patients who just prefer the teapot or the neti pot variety.
Yeah, it might be a West Coast thing, but I definitely have patients who don't like the idea of the plastic, and Whole Foods does sell ceramic versions in the teapot-looking variety of sinus bottles.
Right. Yeah, here on the West Coast, also, we add kale to the irrigation. But you're right. There are these regional variations, and we have our own little personality here on the West Coast.
Right.
So use is pretty universally recommended among sinus surgeons. You quoted a couple of studies where there were surveys, I think, of folks in the American Rhinologic Society, and it was 100% recommended across folks who were fellowship trained in rhinology, and something like 96% of non-fellowship trained folks performing sinus surgery.
Right. The vast majority of both rhinologists and general ENTs do recommend saline washes after sinus surgery.
And so when you were doing your background on this, were you able to find really good evidence that saline irrigation adds value postoperatively in the immediate postoperative period?
There have been some papers, but there's also, I think, a lot of this is based off the consensus statements, such as the International Consensus Statement on Allergy and Rhinology. Dr. Rudnick also had evidence-based review with recommendations that was the basis for a lot of the recommendations for sinus rinses after surgery.
And I think there's a lot of just expert opinion consensus from people who have just used this for years. And if you get them together, they say saline irrigations help people postoperatively. I don't care what the evidence says, it just helps them postoperatively. I would say that the vast majority of us would agree with that. Although I have heard detractors. I've heard folks who would say, well, you're over humidifying the nose and sinuses, and you're putting pools of fluid in the maxillary sinuses, and then fungus grow in those pools of fluid. I've never really had problems, I don't think, with irrigation that way, at least that I'm aware of.
No, I think if anything, I have patients complain that they do their sinus rinse after you've done sinus surgery. They'll do their sinus rinse, and then maybe they'll get in the car and lean over their steering wheel, and some of it will run out. So I think that the saline does run out on. It just takes some technique in order to get it to run out at home in the bathroom before you start your day.
I think that's probably the most common, I guess, side effect that I would say I see with saline irrigation. And I think you're right. Patients can learn to turn their head certain ways that they can avoid that embarrassing spill of fluid from the nose when they're outside of the home. And I also think that there is a learning curve with these, and I try to tell patients that as well, that I actually try to start saline irrigations preoperatively so that in patients who can do it, just so that they can practice it and not have their first postoperative irrigation be the first irrigation of their lifetime. And sometimes I'll tell them to practice in the shower because it can make a bit of a mess when you're learning, and and practicing in the shower, I think, obviates some of that mess.
I agree. I definitely agree.
Okay, so it is beneficial to our patients, and we know that the compliance is pretty good. What did you learn about the patients who are not compliant, the 18 or 20% of patients who are not compliant?
This definitely opened up our eyes to a systems issue at our institution where I was doing my fellowship is when I wrote this. I'm now at a crosstown institution. But we found that our non-native English-speaking patients had decreased compliance. And really, I think part of that was an error on our team's part, not having our translations sufficient to really explain the importance of irrigations and not following up and making sure that the instructions were understood. Since the papers come out, we've corrected that by retranslating our postoperative instructions and also making sure we do a better job educating the family members or any English-speaking friends or family who are available to help us drive home the importance of postoperative saline irrigations. One thing that we found that was interesting in general, though, was that younger patients seem to be more compliant, which is often the opposite of most studies.
Yeah.
And one of our, just anecdotally, is if you ask the younger patients, a lot of them had watched the NeoMed sinus videos on YouTube or watched other sinus videos on YouTube in order to learn how to irrigate better at home. And so we think that there was a technology curve as well, where people who familiarity with watching videos online were faster to pick up the technique and more likely to use their irrigations.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it is interesting. I found that interesting that the younger people were more likely to irrigate. And I think we've all found in our practices that the younger people are less likely to be compliant with many other types of therapies that we prescribe.
And like you said, people who were irrigating before surgery were more likely to irrigate after surgery. So starting irrigations early is definitely important. And then patients who were having revision surgery who had been through the process before were also more likely to irrigate. I think part of that is just the knowledge that the first debridements are very uncomfortable. And the more you irrigate, the less needs to be debrided. And I think that having been through the process before, patients were quicker and more frequently irrigating if they'd had prior surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when did you have the patients, when did you instruct them to start irrigations postoperatively?
The patients received our standard postoperative instructions, which tells them in the absence of either a skull base or an orbital surgery to start irrigations on postoperative day two.
Is that what you do in your practice now? You wait, is it, what, 48 hours to start irrigations?
I do, for the most part.
What is your thinking on that?
I think patients tolerate their irrigations better when they're a little bit less raw and a little bit farther out of anesthesia. I have a lot of patients who have some nausea or pain issues the first day, and just starting the irrigations the second day seems to stress them less than starting it on the first day when they're not feeling well.
Fair enough. I have a little different pattern. So I have them start the next day, so the next morning after sinus surgery, so a little bit earlier than that. I've often wondered, well, gosh, does that put them at higher risk of postoperative epistaxis or something like that? And I don't think that anything like that has ever been studied. I don't think this question of whether you should start it on day one, day two, or day three. I think there are surgeons out there who are hesitant to have patients do it for several days after surgery because of the potential risk of epistaxis or the discomfort associated with it. So I think there's a lot of diversity of practice out there with regard to that.
I think so too.
And then the other issue, the last issue I wanted to talk to you about was the septoplasty. Let's give the listeners some background. There have been a couple of studies published in the last year comparing outcomes among sinus surgeons. And in both of these studies, patients who underwent septoplasty had better outcomes than patients who underwent septoplasty in conjunction with sinus surgery had better outcomes than patients who had sinus surgery without septoplasty. And it surprised me, those findings surprised me a bit. And then in your study, you found once again that even early postoperative outcomes were better in patients who had undergone septoplasty. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. Improved our SNOT 22 scores at our third visit in the septoplasty versus the non-septoplasty group.
Yeah. And I've wondered about this a little bit. I mean, you could say, well, gosh, they had more nasal airway obstruction and you were able to fix that with the septoplasty, so perhaps that is part of it. I've also wondered, though, when you go to perform debridement in a patient who's had septoplasty, their septum is oftentimes asensate, and you're able to do perhaps a more complete debridement in that patient population, which could then improve the outcomes for other reasons.
That's true. And especially with our study only looking at the immediate postoperative period, the first 10 weeks after surgery, the first three postoperative visits, our SNOT 22 scores are not long-term basis. It's just a snapshot in time at how people are feeling on their third visit after their surgery.
Right, right. And so it's kind of a snapshot of very early outcomes, which also seems to fall in line with what we're seeing in the longer-term outcomes as well. So I continue to wonder about that. You didn't find that patients who had septoplasty were more compliant with irrigation or less compliant with irrigation? I've wondered about the septoplasty incision causing more pain with irrigation or perhaps less, since there's an asensate portion of the nasal septum.
You know, I'm not sure if we looked at that specifically. I don't remember looking at that specifically in the statistics about whether people who had septoplasty were more or less likely. I'll have to think about looking at that again and sending in a letter to the editor.
Yeah, there you go. That's what we need, is a letter to the editor. No, I'm just fascinated by how septoplasty manifests itself in the outcomes of this, and what it's probably worth looking at just to see. But maybe I'll have you on the podcast again, and we can discuss that letter to the editor.
All right, sounds great.
All right, well, thanks so much, Elizabeth. Your work's really interesting, and I think it's something that everyone who performs sinus surgery can relate to this and understand it, and hopefully treat their patients even a bit better with this knowledge. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.